Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
On today's episode of Fresnolandia, we are talking with our environmental reporter, Gregory Weaver, about a story coming out this week on how scientists are criticizing the U.S. Forest Service for holding up a prescribed burn in the Sierra National Forest that they say could have prevented the spread of the Garnet Fire, which burned from August to September, consuming 65,000 acres in the Sierra National Forest, which ultimately ended up destroying 4,000 acres of old growth forests in the Tea Kettle Experimental Area and also threatening the McKinley Grove. Greg, you've talked to a lot of scientists for this story and have also dove into the history of prescribed burns and why they matter in our part of this of the country. Why is the Tea Kettle Experimental Area significant from a forestry perspective?
So I think from a bare bones perspective, the Biden administration a few years ago commissioned an inventory of all the old growth forests in the National Forest Service area, so the U.S. National Forest, and there's not a whole lot left. Most of it's either been logged or burned through. And so the Tea Kettle Experimental Forest, it's this huge kind of, it's filled with these huge looming pines above the Kings River. They're at least 500 years old. Basically, scientists have been studying this since the New Deal. It's one of the most intensively studied forests in California. And one of the things that everybody can agree on who isn't like part of the logging industry at this point is that we need to bring back like natural fire into these forest habitats. What it ends up doing is it thins out some of the smaller trees, which suck up water from the big trees during drought. And then it ends up killing the big trees. And then you just have a fire that's very, or a forest that's really easy to burn up. And so the problem is you need a ton of institutional knowledge to get that stuff going. And so the Tea Kettle Experimental Forest, this was going to be one of the first big burns that the Forest Service is going to do that would hopefully get the ball rolling on this kind of, on all this work that needs to get done in the next 10 to 20 years. The reason why it needs to get done and why Tea Kettle was so important, like almost nationally, frankly, was that if we don't get these burns done, a lot more of the national forests are going to die off in drought and they're going to burn up in these mega fires like the Creek Fire and the Garnet Fire. And so there was a lot of interest from not only the Newsom administration. You had universities from New Mexico who were studying this. You had Berkeley scientists who were using this forest as a follow-up to decades of other research they had done. So this Tea Kettle Experimental Forest, it's a really big deal.
Can you describe where it is in relationship to Fresno?
Imagine you're in downtown Fresno and you just hit the 180 east. Basically, it's right above the North Fork of the Kings River. So it's on this ridge line at 8,000, 10,000 feet up in elevation. And it's this forest that sits atop this ridge line. And of course it looks down on the Kings River, but on the other side is this Dinky Creek basin. And if you go a little bit north, you hit Shaver Lake. And one of the things on why everybody wanted to get this Tea Kettle area done because of where it was right there as well, is because the Kings River was the only river that hadn't been jumped by megafire since 2015. So if you started down in Bakersfield at the very southern part of the Sierras and you just looked north, basically that whole mountain area had just been scarred by megafires, these huge fires since 2015. This was the last stretch that hadn't until, of course, the Garnet Fire happens.
And how old are these trees that we're talking about in this forest in the Tea Kettle Experimental Area?
So the way I put in the stories, these things are as old as kind of modern California. They were as old as Christopher Columbus, 1400s, 1300s. These things were coming about. There's bound maybe to be even older trees, unless you sample every single tree and do carbon dating on it. These are only estimates. We will never truly know how old these forests were. The other part about it is that this was a part of the forest that also was adjacent to these groves of old sequoias in the national park.
In McKinley Grove.
Yeah, yeah. And these things are 3,000 years old. And the tragic part about this is that the Garnet Fire, once it started, it grew up this ridge. And that once it hit Tea Kettle itself, these are massive trees. We're talking 10, 15 foot wide trunks. Once the fire starts burning up all that fuel, it just got a second wind. And that's how it surged up the ridge that I'm talking about, went down into the Dinky Creek area. And that's what basically gave it the force to, ended up burning down some of these 3,000-year-old trees as well. It was the bridge from like almost a normal fire to this mega fire that we saw late August.
Can you talk a little bit more about what goes into a prescribed burn? I think it's interesting and helpful for people to understand just the bureaucratic layers of the project and what goes into thinking about how you plan a project like this.
So when I first started reporting on this, people were telling me there's red tape and whatnot. I think the first thing the listener needs to know on the logistics of it is that the Forest Service had cleared themselves of almost all the paperwork needed to get this fire on the ground. There's a saying environmental reviews that normally need to get done. The Forest Service exempted themselves from this. And so the only thing they needed to get done on the paperwork side, and then we'll get on the manpower side, on the paperwork side was just doing these biological surveys. Where are the toads living? Where do they have their mating habitats and whatnot? It's already a pretty well-studied forest, so like these things weren't very difficult. We can go into what happened with trying to acquire these surveys later on, but then you have to get the manpower involved, and oftentimes it's a funding issue. People are always talking about the Forest Service. They can't get these good fires going like that everybody agrees that we need to be doing because there's just not enough money. The Newsom administration solved that problem too. Not only was the paperwork basically all the red tape cut, Newsom gave $5.6 million for something like a 50 to 100 man crew to get this done. The research team that was going to get this burn done, they had Cal Fire. They were going to supply all the choppers on it. They had the full aerial team done. It was basically these biological surveys that was dot your I's and cross your T's that held this thing up for years and is why an outsider looking in on this could maybe say, oh, the paperwork killed them. It's my reporting really shows that this huge forest, this old forest, this precious forest got at all its survival all came down to these delays.
What's the stalling?
So basically what happened is these scientists asked the Forest Service for these areas where they should do biological surveys. They started doing this in 2019, 2020. They initially thought, oh, okay, we'll have the complete information by March of 2023. That's a pretty big timeline just to get the surveys done. That's given themselves 3 years. The Forest Service didn't give them even the requirements of it till fall of 2024. So we're talking years and years just to respond to these requirements of where the surveys needed to get done. And so then you got to get people to go out and do all this stuff. But the holdup, I think ultimately what people told me was the local unit just wasn't engaged on this project. One of the contractors on the project told me that it never felt like this thing was a priority. The lead investigator from New Mexico told me that the Forest Service just isn't acting with the urgency that's required for these forests to avoid getting burned down in these massive wildfires.
And this precedes DOGE, this precedes government shutdowns. This has been going on for a long time, correct?
What makes this such an interesting case study was this is the high noon of the Biden administration. We're talking 2020, 2021, 2022, 2023, which the Forest Service had as much support as they probably have had over the course of the 21st century. You had Biden's huge infrastructure bills get passed, which put in a bunch of money into the Forest Service. So it had all of the winds blowing at its back. And so I think this is a real test case for what is the Forest Service capable of in remotely its current form. And it couldn't get this project done even after 6 years of more or less people holding their hands on every single detail and cutting all the red tape and giving them all the money and whatnot.
So the scientific community has really landed with a lot of consensus around the importance of prescribed burns and in forest management and making sure that we're protecting our forests for years to come. So if it's not a liberal conservative thing,
But Donnie, I do think that prescribed burns are often coded as conservative, categorized that way, but you're saying that's not what it's actually like in the industry.
No, it's not. And Greg, I'm hoping you can illuminate the different camps of forest management and how that might play into the Forest Service's lack of urgency.
So this story has a case study of the 2020 Creek Fire, which is just so stark in its outcomes. We think of it as just this complete devastation. But I think it also showed really what approaches work that will prevent wildfires. So, of course, we know the Creek Fires, this massive thing near Shaver Lake, it just annihilated everything in its path. But what ended up happening when I was looking at why exactly it burned the way it did was that there was forest basically right across the street from the Forest Service area that ended up burning, which didn't burn. And it had all this prescribed burning and thinning and whatnot. And so what happens with the problems that the Forest Service is encountering, what's the holdup and whatnot, is I think you're up against this 30-year history of what's happened to the Forest Service since the 1990s. Everybody knows that the Forest Service suppressed fire during its early periods in the 1920s to the 1960s. And in the 1960s, there was like this awakening. The National Park Service in Yosemite, for example, they started doing more prescribed burning and whatnot, and they did it successfully. And when the 2012 drought hit, these trees were they had been taken care of more or less enough to the point where they were able to survive the drought. The Forest Service never implemented prescribed burning the way the National Park Service did. They're managed by different agencies. So National Park Service, that's run by the Department of Interior, but the National Forest Service is run by the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. And so what ended up happening is the USDA is highly dependent on timber companies to manage their forests for basically the middle of the 20th century. And they suppressed fire for a long time, not because they wanted to preserve the land like a national park. They suppressed fire, and this is what I heard from Stephen Pine. He's this incredible fire historian. They want to suppress fire because it would preserve the biggest trees to get harvested. They spent about 50 years clear-cutting all the biggest trees, and by the 1980s, it's all gone. And what happened is they pull back from all their harvests, and the USDA, they're not harvesting anymore. What does the Forest Service need to do anymore if the timber guys aren't harvesting? So they ended up cutting, over the course of 30 years, 50 to 75% of all their staff. The forestry technicians used to be the biggest kind of group in the Forest Service. They've been cut by 50%. The only kind of job category that's gone up in the Forest Service over the last 30 years is firefighters. They're not managing the forest, they're dealing with the meltdowns of the forest. That's how kind of the institutional structure has been bogged down in it, and all this disinvestment, frankly, from the federal government.
Yeah. Greg, do you think the Forest Service has the experience on staff in order to accomplish these prescribed burns in your analysis?
It took them 5 years to give them just a location of where to do a survey. These are the sort of bottlenecks that happen at the Forest Service after all this history.
One of your sources is advocating for a recall of the current Forest Service supervisor. But how much is this an individual issue versus kind of the agency culture, philosophy, the conversation, what you were just talking about?
Yeah, I think when it comes to, so there's a guy named Freddie Serrano, grew up in Fresno County. He spent a lot of time up in the mountains. After the Garnet Fire hit and after he found out what happened with Tea Kettle, he started this petition that's been circulating online for the recall of this forest supervisor who's been in charge of the area that was hit by the Creek Fire and also the Garnet Fire. He's been there for 10, 15 years. His name's Dean Gould. And Serrano. So one of the big problems a really shocking statistic in the story is that under Gould's leadership, the amount of forest treatment that the forests around Fresno are getting, it's declined 50% since its peak in 2018. So you got all these new threats. Everybody's saying we need to be doing something. And we're actually cutting back on the amount of work we're doing, even with record funding from the Forest Service. So it's getting bumped up. Biden's doing stuff. This Tea Kettle project really is about how you got support from every other corner of this whole nonprofit university state government. Cal Fire is giving them everything. I think when it comes down to residents, they're looking to have some kind of part of accountability on this, to give some pressure to the Forest Service on the public side to do better on these sort of forests. Now, I don't know if, I think frankly, the Forest Service has gone decades without a whole lot of accountability. I think at the very least, the residents are asking for some hard questions to be asked from what exactly is the leadership team prioritizing over here, if not this key force that had full funding and they had said they would complete the burn by 2024, which would have likely saved this Tea Kettle forest from burning down.
Let's take stock of what we lost. So this prescribed burn didn't happen. What did we lose?
Scientists have been studying this forest for generations. It was a part of these experimental research stations where I mean, it's about 4,000 acres, and scientists had spent, there's probably four, five, six careers, generations of scientists that had like painstakingly parceled out this massive ranch and had done different experiments on them in order to make deductions about what causes certain effects on the health of the forest. So that was all completely burned through during this fire. All these experiments, some of them take decades to run. That's gone. It's going to take decades to get that back up. And frankly, there's not a whole lot of these experimental areas in California that are getting used right now. So I, at the very least, it sets back our understanding of these forests a generation. And then on the, and then people in McKinley Grove, there's the 3,000-year-old trees are lost. These are just like the giants of the modern world, yeah. One of these wonders.
Yeah, Donnie, a few episodes ago, you were mentioning what you were loving that week was being in the High Sierras. What do these trees mean to you?
I was literally at McKinley Grove the day the fire started, which is so weird now to think about. So, yeah, it's really sad. It's such a part of our backyard. Prescribed burns is obviously important for climate reasons, but to so many people who live in Fresno, certainly those of us on the valley floor, but then also indigenous people in the region, it's just a huge part of our community. It's yeah. Such a bummer.
There's a lot of other tribes that were going to be at the burn as well to get all the, to try and revive this institutional knowledge with tribes that was lost when California's colonized and it's taken over by all these federal agencies. There's all these burn collaboratives that tribes are doing on reservations, and they're really trying to learn from some of the firefighters on the Forest Service side and CAL FIRE and whatnot. And so they're also not going to have an opportunity to learn from this. It's going to take years probably to find another spot to create an occasion where they can learn that as well. But I think like the big thing that's lost for me, frankly, is I think there's this five-year hypothesis that comes about. Donnie, you and I got in this work when something like the Green New Deal with decarbonization and progressive policy was going about. And I think we're at the tail end of that cycle of policymaking right now. And I think this story really shows how much, once you cut back on government, how really difficult it is to make things right and try and deal with problems that we need to address right now. We need to have addressed them 20 years ago. And 5 years of a project that didn't have a whole lot of hurdles in its way, this agency found ways to trip over itself. And now we're just asking how, like, people are asking, like, where do we go next with this? How do you recover from it?
And it's such a, I feel like, a lesson to learn for so many different industries where, you know, right now the abundance agenda is really big right now and everyone's just, if we just cut the tape, we'll solve the problems. And
you need to understand what the tape is there for first.
Yes.
And I think that's what gets lost in these abundance of abundance conversations.
Yes, very much.
This thing is even talking about how their basic idea is flawed. They had cut all the red tape. You had given them all the money. You had everybody basically doing the homework of these agencies. Everybody, like, it was all there on a silver platter, and it just, this massive project died on the vine.
We conclude these podcasts each week with what we're loving this week. Greg, I'm going to start with you. In episodes past, you've talked about baseball.
That's right.
You're going to go off.
Is that what you're loving this week? Because we're down to four teams.
I can't. I'm not loving baseball. That wasn't the first thing on my mind.
Okay, although, what is?
Know, I'm a Giants fan, but I am.
It's a hard time to be a Giants fan. Just watching the Dodgers just slide towards that pennant. For the second year in a row?
I'm split on this, all right? Because normally Giants fan, they would rather die than root for the Dodgers or even watch a Dodger game. But I kind of like how much the ownership of the Dodgers has invested in the team. They got this great roster. You see a lot of teams across all these sports. They're good a few years, and then they hit the luxury tax, and they gut the teams after that. And the Dodgers, the ownership there, I think they really stand out in American sports as not doing that. And so I think it's really nice to see that sort of excellence rewarded with like long-term success. Plus, I just selfishly, I want to see Ohtani break all these records. Like,
same.
I'll never see a human do what he's doing again. Why not? But the big thing I discovered this weekend is marinating chicken in buttermilk.
That was a turn right
yeah.
there.
That is what
Tell us more.
Yeah. Have you guys ever done that before?
No. Yes. Yes, I've done that.
Jesus. So I did both chicken thighs and chicken breast. And I think it's a combination of it adds a little bit of more fat and a little bit of saltiness. So it adds this nice thing. The sugars, it caramelizes well when you're grilling them. But really the big part about it is that the enzymes of the milk kind of break down the chicken. And so it hits a whole different register of tenderness. Right? Like chicken breasts especially, because there's not a whole lot of fat to really elevate the thing, it tasted like chicken thigh. It had the texture and the succulence of a chicken thigh. So that's kind of like a food hack deal that I'll be eating while I watch, hopefully, Ohtani hit 5 home runs during the World Series.
You heard it here. Marinate your meat. Donnie, what are you loving this week?
Okay, so my family got an old school landline phone this last week.
Nice.
Like with a cord and everything. And my kids are obsessed, and my phone rings now, and like my daughter will be like, hello, this is Eliana speaking.
Oh my God.
Greg, did you grow up with this, or are you too young to
No, yeah, my parents still have a landline.
Oh, they
in their
do?
House.
Okay, yeah. Like when I was a kid, it was like everyone had a landline, of course, and everyone would fight over the phone. And
do you remember when cordless happened and you could steal it and
absolutely.
Take it? Yeah, and there was no wire. Whew.
Oh, yes. So many prank calls. So sorry, friends of my sister's. Anyways, so it's been fun. My kids have been arranging their own play dates over the last week.
So there's a lot of phone traffic.
Oh, tons. And it's okay. Only for my kids. No one calls for me. It's just literally for my kids.
Interesting. Like so maybe they'll not have cell phones for an extra few years.
We're trying to push off cell phones as long as possible. And so I feel like this is going to hopefully buy us like 3 or 4 more years.
And it's a cordless you have?
It's a cord phone.
It's corded. So that's a supervision right there.
Yeah, exactly. We put it in our dining room and we just put like a little lounge chair in the corner so they can sit in the lounge chair.
Yeah, give them some ambiance while they're doing their phone calls.
Yeah.
I can picture your daughter just running the string around her finger.
1,000%. Her and her little bestie right now, they like call each other at 8 o'clock in the morning and they're like, hello, oh, what did you do at school today? I did this. It's adorable.
What I'm loving this week is Pinky's Pizza. It's a pizza pop-up located in kind of northwest Fresno, and it's been on hiatus for a little while, but last Friday was its grand return, and it is my favorite pizza in town.
Yeah, same.
And it, I don't know, Donnie, what do you think makes it distinctive for you, aside from the personal attachments to it?
Dude, I am not a food writer, so don't make me say...
Just tell me why you like it.
It's just good.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, it's good.
The crust is really good.
Yeah.
It bends correctly.
I think the crust is key.
Yeah.
Because the guy that operates is James. He is a dough nerd.
Yeah.
And so
follow him on Instagram.
Yeah, you follow him on Instagram, follow Pinky's Pizza. You'll see him experimenting continuously. I don't know how he eats that much pizza. I respect it because there's a lot of experiments
where
you're watching him make a pizza on a Tuesday night and you're like, wow, I just saw 3 in a row.
What kind of oven is he running?
What's that?
What kind of oven is he running?
What is the brand?
Is it like electric, wood?
Yeah, it's electric.
Coal?
I think it's electric. We might be speaking out of school, but yeah, I would encourage people, if you're interested in some really good pizza, find Pinky's. And the trick is, and I think you know this more than I do, you have to it's like a hot plate drop. So you got to do it ASAP, like 5-10 minutes basically. Mm-hmm. And it usually drops what day?
Ooh, I don't think he has a consistent date.
Yeah, it's like somewhere in the middle of the week and it's midday typically, and you got to get fast fingers.
It
fast
sells
fingers.
Out within 10 minutes.
Within 10 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, you got to be on it.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.